No one could shut Warren up, and it was his intent on delivering the message, even revealing it to the deputies who were escorting him out of the courthouse. He would make the same confession to several FLDS leaders and family members, recorded on the jail's payphone, admitting that he had never been God's messenger. And he knew that because, of course, God had told him so. While his followers believed everything else he said, this was more than they could bear to accept. The entire episode became comical as Warren tried to convince his people that he was a fraud and a liar, saying, "The truth is not in me." Even after confessing to his mother and several church leaders that he had immoral relations with a sister and a daughter, nobody would listen. He had conditioned them so completely that not even he could reverse the brainwashing. One regular visitor to the jail was Warren's brother Nephi, and the scene of Warren admitting to him once again that he was not and never had been the prophet was caught on the jail surveillance tape. Nephi disagreed, insisting just as strongly that Warren was the prophet, and this was only another of the Lord's tests.
"Just a minute," Warren replied,
as a blank stare settled over his countenance. He momentarily looked away from his brother, apparently receiving a strong and clear voice that no one else could hear.
"This is a message from God," he insisted,
still listening to the communication from on high.
"This is not a test."
As sad as it was, I broke out laughing while watching the pitiful scene on video. When the jailer took Warren from the visiting room, the shocked Nephi remained motionless for several minutes, his hands over his face, weeping. Despite being locked up, Warren was still able to manage the affairs of the church. According to his records, he was able to smuggle out documents and communications which skirted jail security, including a detailed schematic of Warren's jail cell and its location inside the purgatory facility. There also were detailed instructions to his counselors, directions to kick some FLDS members out of their homes, move some others to places of refuge, and assign routine household chores to various wives. Warren, at least for a little while, was back in form. I got the chance to see the prophet in person when I accompanied attorneys Roger and Greg Houle to a deposition in May 2007 at Purgatory. It involved a new client named Wendell Musser, who Warren had kicked out and was determined to prevent from visiting his own infant son. Musser had been ordered by Warren to be the caretaker for several of the prophet's wives at a hideout near Florence, Colorado, while the prophet was on the run. When Musser was arrested for driving under the influence on his way back to the safe house one evening, Warren was furious. The incident might have tipped off the police to the refuge location where his wives were hidden. Wendell was told to go away and repent from a distance, which he did. After a couple weeks, the separation from his family became unbearable, and he tried to return to see his wife and son, only to find the house had been abandoned and his wife and child gone. Warren had assigned them to another man. Wendell was beside himself, broke with the prophet, and started legal proceedings to at least get legal visitation rights with his son. Musser turned out to be a world of information on the inner workings of some of the FLDS hierarchy. The day of our visit, the prophet was extremely gaunt, and a green and white striped jail uniform hung on him. Beneath the short-sleeved pullover, he wore thermal long johns with long sleeves, despite the fact that it was midsummer. He had made a point of showing his followers that he was sticking to the religious mandate of covering his flesh. The shorts and T-shirt in which he was photographed when arrested were explained away as having been a necessary evil to blend into the Gentile world. He knew exactly who I was, and he gave a polite, "How are you?" when we were introduced. I was pleased that he was looking better than the last time I had seen him in the courtroom. Richard Wright, Warren's Nevada attorney, was present. And on the advice of counsel, Warren exercised his right not to answer Roger and Greg's questions for fear he might incriminate himself. He refused to answer even the most benign and elementary of questions. After about 30 minutes of listening to Warren plead the Fifth, we decided to leave. As I stood up, Warren unexpectedly thrust his hand out to me, and without thinking, I automatically took it. I immediately felt that I had made a terrible mistake. I had no desire to shake hands with someone that I knew to be the perpetrator of such heinous crimes against children. I had lost sleep over the brutality that Warren had inflicted on children and his own people, and felt that the custom might intimate some sort of tolerance for his atrocities. I would rather have kept things on a strictly formal basis minus the handshake. At least I did not get the treatment that my buddy Gary Ingalls got when he first met Warren. The Prophet had surprised Gary, too, by telling Ingalls that he forgave Gary for persecuting him. Jeff's didn't lay a surprise blessing on me, but as I left the jail, I felt the overwhelming need to wash my hands. The Prophet was aware that we intended to report his non-cooperation to the judge and that we would seek a contempt of court order, but that wasn't much motivation for someone who was already in jail to answer our questions. But I had an idea for another way to apply pressure. I dug around and found out that Warren's commissary account was kept filled with the maximum amount of money allowed by jail regulations. So we devised a motion for the court to seize that money and any other assets we could find for as long as Warren refused to speak to us, and earmark those funds to cover my investigative fees for locating Wendell's family. Minutes before the commissary account was to be seized, our client's wife and son suddenly showed up at his front door, and Wendell Musser was able to obtain a legal order providing for visitation with the boy. The Prophet gave in rather than surrender his ability to buy his jail goodies. The small victories were adding up, and it seemed to make up for the handshake. Chapter 31. Alyssa. A long year passed between the preliminary hearing and the trial of Warren Jeffs in Utah for the two felony charges of rape as an accomplice, but much was happening. The FLDS and its Prophet had never before been taken to the mat as they had been over the past few years, and part of my job was to continue staying a jump ahead of them. During that stretch, we finished our work on the Lost Boys and the Brent Jeffs civil suits. They were won by default because the Prophet refused to appear in court. We may have won, but our clients did not want to be put in the position of collecting monetary damages from their own families. They chose instead to make a public statement that their goal was to effect change within the community by bringing to light the rampant child abuse hidden in the shadows. Each client received a token piece of property in Short Creek. A trust fund to help other displaced children remains a future possibility. One unexpected result of our lawsuits against Warren and the FLDS Church led to a parting of the ways between Jeff's and his longtime Salt Lake City attorney, Rodney R. Parker. The sandy-haired lawyer tried to convince Jeffs that he could lose everything if he didn't step up and defend it. Warren fired him, answered them nothing, and lost. Jury selection for the Jeffs trial began on September 7, 2007, and part of my job was to keep Elyssa Wall beyond the reach of the FLDS and the media, getting her safely to and from the courtroom. That proved to be a logistical nightmare because the media was stacked up everywhere, and I believe the FLDS loyalists hated her enough to endanger her safety. Chief Enforcer Willie Jessup or his buddies would park right in the open, directly in front of the glass-fronted entranceway to the building in which Brock Belknap, the Washington County prosecutor, had his office, and just sit there peering in. The silent message? We are watching. So we made careful arrangements with the court, its staff, the bailiff, and the police to maneuver the witness from the secret location where she was staying to the courthouse, which was in the middle of a cordoned-off two-square-block area. Timing had to be precise, for Warren Jeffs also would be moved through the building, and the court wanted no chance encounters. For help, I once again enlisted John Krakauer, who had become a good friend that I could trust to move quickly and wisely if things got tight. The trial began a week later on September 13th, and after John and I navigated Alyssa through the media madhouse, she took her place in the second row between Roger Houle and her husband Lamont. I went to my assigned aisle seat two rows behind her. Reporters filled most of the other seats, but a group of FLDS loyalists sat nearby to support their prophet, glaring at Alyssa. The opening statements were crucial, and Belknap focused the scope of the trial for the jury. It had nothing to do with religion nor with polygamy. He said the state would prove that the defendant, Warren Jeffs, was an accomplice in the incestuous rape of a 14-year-old minor child. The trial was about that, and only that. Making the defense argument was another member of the FLDS legal team, the impeccably coiffed and dressed Tara Isaacson. She insinuated that no rape had occurred, at all, that any sex that took place had been consensual, and that Alyssa had initiated contact. I have been through many trials involving sexual abuse, and the defense almost always launches a rabid attack upon the victim. That strategy would be followed precisely in this trial. One reason the defense chose Isaacson is that they clearly wanted another female to grill Alyssa about intimate details. Isaacson's entire presentation had been carefully built into a computerized PowerPoint presentation that would lead the jury through the events. But when the computer malfunctioned, Isaacson was left stumbling for words without the video guide. She bored in as coldly as possible, but did not do a very good job at presenting her argument off the cuff. Alyssa had been nervous on the drive into court that morning, fussing with her long hair, but once she took the witness stand, she settled in quickly, as Craig Barlow from the Utah Attorney General's office led her through her testimony. I watched the jurors carefully as they were introduced to the grim life of a girl inside the FLDS. They sat stone-faced as she described the total lack of sex education, the way girls and boys were taught to treat the opposite gender as they would treat snakes, and how a girl would be assigned by the prophet to an older man she might not even know. As we drove home that evening, she wanted to know if she had done all right, how I thought the jury was reacting, and she worried about the upcoming defense cross-examination. She was expressing normal insecurities, and I gave her comforting words, but I had been unable to read anything into the day. I had learned over the years that the best policy was to be positive, but non-committal. That night, we parked Krakauer's car with a bicycle lashed to the top, inside the sallyport at the courthouse, and left it there. Then we made sure that everyone saw Alyssa arrive for the second day of trial in the pickup truck. Willie Jessup was up to his old antics, treating the court process as some kind of game and attempting to intimidate our witness. He tried to rearrange the assigned seating in the courtroom so that he could sit directly in Alyssa's line of sight during her testimony and behind her in the courtroom. It was the same intimidation tactic that the FLDS had pulled in Arizona during the Candy Shapley testimony. This time, a savvy bailiff picked up on what was happening and gave Willie a warning, which he ignored. The bailiff informed the judge, and two deputies removed Jessup from the courthouse. He was barred for the remainder of the trial. Alyssa testified that day about the impossibility of her leaving Short Creek rather than obey the prophet. She was only 14 at the time, was not old enough to drive, had no money, and lived in an FLDS community, completely dependent upon the family to which her mother had been reassigned after her father had been kicked out of the church and banished.
"I had no options," she declared.
I believed her, and I thought the jury did too. Her description of the sham marriage ritual performed by Warren Jeffs at the Caliente Motel in Nevada and the eventual rape by Alan Steed was harrowing. In a tearful voice, she told the spellbound court that when Alan, her 19-year-old cousin, began to undress her, she begged,
"I can't do this. Please don't." I was sobbing. My whole entire body was shaking. I was so scared. He didn't stop. He just laid me onto the bed and had sex.
The defense took its turn after the lunch break in court, and Tara Isaacson spent the afternoon lashing Alyssa with sharp questions designed to make the witness look like a vengeful adult woman at the time of her wedding, instead of a brainwashed underage child who was forced into an illegal sexual arrangement and into having sex against her will. Alyssa had plenty of options, Isaac declared, but chose not to use them. I thought that was a ridiculous argument, since a 14-year-old cannot legally consent to sex in any situation. Left unsaid was that Alyssa's entire life up until that point had been one of those keep-sweet journeys that had intentionally limited her choices. When it was time to leave, at the end of the day, we had a woman member of our team slip into the pickup truck that we had used to come to court in the morning to serve as a decoy for the media and the FLDS. Right behind the pickup, John and Alyssa calmly drove off in the opposite direction in John's waiting car with the bike attached, totally ignored. I was right on their bumper to make sure we were not followed. The next day, Alyssa's sister, Teresa Wall Blackmore, testified, recalling how the sad, hopeless, depressed Alyssa had telephoned her the day after her wedding, crying throughout the conversation.
She hated to be near him, Teresa said of Alyssa's feelings for Alan.
The defense did not question her. Becky Wall, another sister, followed and underlined Alyssa's testimony. She also attempted to define the treacherous keep-sweet policy within the FLDS.
Even when it hurts, you were to act happy. That was how you conquered the evil inside of you.
I blanched at that and flashed back to a conversation with one of my sources. The man had been summoned to the Jeff's compound to meet the prophet himself and had found Warren in a posh office, seated in what was described as a tricked-out massage lounger with built-in speakers. Reclined in comfort, Jeff's delivered a training about the man having a dark heart and how he was no longer worthy to hold priesthood and be in the church. On the bottom of Warren's fancy left boot was written the word keep, and on the right one was sweet. He then cast the man out of the church and community, broke up his family, and devastated his life from the comfort of his fancy recliner. The final witness for the state was almost an afterthought. Jane Blackmore, a veteran midwife in Canada and first wife of Winston Blackmore, before leaving the faith and her husband. She had delivered hundreds of babies and had treated scores of FLDS girls below the age of 18 for pregnancies that were terminated due to complications. Among those unfortunate girls was Alyssa Wall, who had suffered a miscarriage while visiting family members in Canada during the time she was pregnant with Alan Steed's baby. The defense put on a case that had little meat to it. Warren Jeffs did not testify in his own behalf, so Walter Bugden and Tara Isaacson were relying on Alan Steed, who spoke so softly that he was admonished by the judge several times to speak up. Out of frustration, Steed ended up standing in the witness box to deliver his testimony so he could be better heard, but really only succeeded in looking foolish. The prosecution had delayed filing charges against Steed until after Warren's case had been decided, to prevent the FLDS and the press from discovering Alyssa's identity. Now that secrecy was no longer a factor, Steed realized that he was trapped. He knew that it was illegal in the state of Utah to have sex with a 14-year-old girl, no matter what the circumstances. So to admit to sex with Alyssa in any fashion would be tantamount to admitting to a crime. It was obvious that a rape charge would soon be heading his way. So he lawyered up with a little-known Salt Lake City defense attorney by the name of Jim Bradshaw. Bradshaw seemed to be out to make a name for himself in a very high-profile case. It did neither of them much good. Any competent defense attorney would urge that his client not say anything that may be incriminating, a constitutional right guaranteed by the Fifth Amendment. But Steed either got bad advice or didn't listen to his lawyer. He repeatedly admitted under oath to having had sex with the girl. Both sides rested their cases on Friday, and the jury began deliberations, but was granted a weekend break after a few hours. For Alyssa and the prosecution team,
That meant holding our breaths in anticipation. Nobody had been able to read the faces or body language of the stoic jurors. I had no idea which way they would go, and things wrapped up so quickly that it had seemed surreal. On Tuesday, September 25, 2007, the trial ended with total vindication for Elissa Wall. Warren Jess was found guilty on both counts of being an accomplice to the rape of a minor. Alan Steed was charged with rape the day after the Jeffs verdict. In November, after 2 months of a pre-sentencing investigation, Judge Shumate gave Jeffs the maximum penalty under Utah law. Each count carried a 5 years-to-life prison sentence, to be served back-to-back. In addition, there was a cumulative fine of $37,000. I stood in the parking lot of the Washington County Attorney's Office after the sentencing and watched a helicopter take off to ferry the prophet straight from the courthouse to the Utah State Prison at Point of the Mountain, some 20 miles south of Salt Lake City. There, Warren Jeffs, in shackles, hobbled into his new world. It was a good day. The once powerful religious fanatic had become a very small fish in a very large pool of sharks, subject to regular prison protocol. All of the special privileges were stripped away as he went into lockdown, shattered by the sudden realization that the heavens had once again failed to intervene on his behalf. Despite the money, the influence, the high-powered lawyers, and the devotion of his flock, Warren had lost everything because of his crimes. An attorney tried to take his deposition in prison and reported that Warren was so mentally out of it that he had been chained to a wall for his own safety. His only communication with the outside world was through his attorneys. A few months later, in February 2008, he was extradited from Utah to the jail in Kingman, Arizona, to await trial on 4 counts of sexual misconduct with a minor, 4 counts of incest, and 1 count of conspiracy to commit sexual conduct with a minor. Warren Steed Jeffs received 2 life sentences for his crimes in Utah, had been extradited to Arizona to face additional charges there, and had a federal fugitive charge waiting in the wings after the state charges were completed to seal his fate. It began to appear as if Warren may finally have been taken to task. But 5 months later, an emotionally disturbed young woman picked up her telephone and dialed the New Bridge Family Shelter in San Angelo, Texas, claiming to be an abused teenage bride named Sarah, who was being held prisoner at the YFZ Ranch. Chapter 32. Sarah. On March 29, 2008, Elissa Thomas at the New Bridge Family Shelter in San Angelo, Texas, listened carefully to a sobbing, breaking young voice on the crisis hotline, hoping to establish some sort of personal bond that would persuade the troubled caller to trust her. This one seemed a little different. Perhaps the caller was a little more desperate, but it was a challenge getting the details from her. Information emerged only in bits and pieces, and the hotline veteran was convinced the caller was a terrified victim of child abuse. After 42 minutes, including several long pauses, the conversation finally came to a tenuous close. The girl promised to call again. Thomas was dubious. She had heard that same promise many times before from other girls looking for help, and that second call seldom came. This one did. In fact, over the next 2 days, the same girl telephoned frequently and would stay on the line anywhere from a few moments to more than an hour. Jessica Carroll, another experienced hotline volunteer, pitched in to field some of the calls. Working around the caller's bouts of uncontrollable weeping, the women pieced together a shocking but disturbingly familiar tale. Victims of child sexual abuse are smothered by fear, guilt, embarrassment, and shame. As a general rule, the perpetrators of the crime are skilled at keeping their victim quiet by keeping them too terrified to reveal their dark secrets. Hotline workers are trained to break that stranglehold and convince the anonymous callers to take a giant leap of faith and believe they will be safe in exposing the harm that has befallen them. In this new case, enough details seeped out during the meandering conversations for the workers to begin a preliminary profile of the victim. The caller said her name was Sarah. She claimed to be 16 years old and said she had been placed in a polygamous marriage when she was only 15. She already had one baby, was pregnant again, and her husband, who was 49, beat her. When coaxed to give her location, Sarah said that she was confined to one of the buildings at the fortress-like religious compound called the Yearning for Zion Ranch outside of El Dorado, Texas. The caller insisted that the prophet Warren Jeffs himself had chosen and sealed her to her husband, who already had several other wives. She had been at the ranch for 3 years. Her parents did not live there. The mention of Warren Jeffs and his YFZ ranch rang loud alarm bells with the hotline workers. Everybody in the area knew about the polygamous YFZ compound and knew that Jeffs and his cult believed their eternal salvation depended upon the practice of plural marriage, including placing little girls with much older men. Even though 6 months earlier the prophet had been convicted in Utah of being an accomplice to rape and now is in jail in Arizona awaiting trial on additional charges, Sarah nevertheless was still clearly terrified. Carol and Thomas finally had heard enough. They pressed a speed dial button that connected their phones directly to the Texas Department of Public Safety, the Texas Rangers. A few days later, on April 1, 2008, my own telephone rang at my office in Cedar City. "Sam, I need your opinion on something." It was Flora Jessup. And if Flora was calling, I could be sure that the subject would have something to do with the FLDS. Over the past 4 years, while I had been chasing Jeffs and working on legal actions involving the FLDS and the United Effort Plan Trust, I had stayed in contact with Flora, whose activism against the church that had misused her as a child was unrelenting. She always had her ear to the ground. Jeffs was in prison. But the church remained strong, isolated, as suspicious of outsiders as ever, and extremely secretive. I had believed for some time that things were approaching some kind of tipping point, and whatever it was probably was going to involve that fortress temple down in Texas. "Hey," I said. "What's up?"
"A young girl is calling me. She says her name is Sarah, and she claims that she is being kept against her will by the FLDS. She sounds like she wants to get out, but I'm not completely sure."
It is not uncommon for a scared FLDS girl to call Flora for help, but most of them vacillate at the moment of truth and change their minds, unable to let go of the demented life that has been thrust upon them. "So what can I do for you?" Flora knew the drill as well as anyone. Get the facts, call the authorities. She asked if I would listen in on the next call and help assess the situation. Was this really a little girl in trouble, or was something else going on? The Short Creek police had threatened to arrest Flora for helping other girls escape from the FLDS, and she needed to be sure this wasn't some sort of setup. Before long, the mysterious Sarah made contact again, and Flora brought me on the line to let me eavesdrop. A perfectly legal action in 38 states, including Arizona and Utah, with the consent of only one party to the call. To keep from spooking the caller, I muted my phone and listened over the speaker, turning on a tape recorder to capture the conversation. I heard a shaky voice relating still another sad and disturbing story from inside the church. And I listened with an investigator's neutral, professional ear, because I had heard similar stories, this bad and worse, from many other girls. After only a few minutes, my impressions began to take shape. This kid used FLDS terminology, a certain style of speech unique to Short Creek, like calling the pizza place Crego's, or the grocery store the CMC. She knew Mormon religious terms,
used FLDS idioms that an outsider would not know, and provided accurate information about Short Creek, from the medical clinic to the local store. My conclusion after that first call was, "Dang, she's got a lot of information." However, it would be imprudent to listen in on a call that came in out of the blue, from someone I don't know and can't interview, and just take it at face value. As an investigator, and as I accumulate more information, I am in the habit of not only evaluating, but constantly reevaluating every story and piece of evidence that I come across. Until I am able to actually see and personally assess the person on the other end of the line, I will always have a certain degree of doubt concerning the veracity of the caller. My impression was that she was probably a member of the FLDS or at least somehow involved. If the call to Flora was a setup, hoax, or just some sort of practical joke, the person on the other end of the line was damn good at it, and she had done her homework. The jolting centerpiece of her story was the assertion that she was only 16 years old and had been abused by her own father, had been made pregnant by him, and had a miscarriage. An FLDS doctor had been summoned to the home but had refused to take her to the medical clinic for treatment. That was a match, because the FLDS uses public hospitals only as a last resort, and she knew the name of the doctor, Lloyd Barlow. She said she had been forced to clean up the mess herself. Sarah avoided saying where she was. She seemed afraid and unwilling to commit to have someone go and help her. That reaction was also totally consistent with the situation, since all FLDS children are taught to distrust the outside world. I was privy to several calls over the next few days, as Sarah fleshed out her ever more riveting narrative. It was becoming impossible not to lend credence to the precise details. Everything might not be exactly accurate, but something was going on with her. She was, without a doubt, terrified. Neither Flora nor I had ever set eyes on this mystery caller. We made the decision to turn our information over to a trusted law enforcement agency to carry the information farther through the system. The following day, Wednesday, April 2nd, Leslie Brooks Long, a sergeant in Company E of the Texas Rangers, drove over to see the volunteers at the Newbridge Family Shelter. Long had worn the famed little silver badge with the circled star since 1997, and his turf covered a great deal of West Texas. He had received specialized training on sexual assault against children. He interviewed Carol and Thomas independently and listened to the tapes of the soft voice on the recorded hotline. The caller had finally identified herself as Sarah Jessup, with a date of birth of January 13th, 1992. She said she was the mother of a baby who was 8 months old. Ranger Long did the math. If that birthday was correct, then Sarah was 16. And if the baby was 8 months, Sarah could not have been more than 15 when the child was conceived. Now she was pregnant again. Sarah had told the hotline volunteers that she had lived at the YFZ ranch since she was 13 and that Jessup was her maiden name. She had been placed with an FLDS man whom she identified as Dale Barlow, who she said hit and hurt her both physically and sexually. The ranger knew that a 15-year-old girl could not legally consent to sex in the state of Texas. According to the law, Sarah was also too young to be the legal spouse of Dale Barlow or anyone else. Sarah's dark story had spun out through more calls to the hotline, and she had been asked about the possibility of escaping her captors. Sarah was terrified at the consequences of getting caught if she tried to escape the only life she had ever known. There was a manned guard tower at the main entrance to the YFZ ranch, as well as mounds of slag and debris, piled high in strategic locations that provided sentries with a view of the entire compound and beyond the fences that enclosed it. With guards always around, she was even torn in her decision to seek help. She wavered, changed her mind, switched from promising the hotline workers that she would try to escape to asking them to forget that she had ever called. Momentum was building, though. A child in distress draws a strong and immediate response from law enforcement.
If the girl was in danger, the ranger realized that time was of the essence. He ran a check on Barlow through law enforcement databases and found that an FLDS member named Dale Evans Barlow had been convicted in Arizona of unlawful sexual conduct with a minor, and as part of his sentence had been given 3 years of probation beginning in August 2005. That probation was still in effect, a fact that added validity to Sarah's claim. Long decided there was probable cause to obtain a warrant to search the YFZ ranch, and a major investigation began to take shape as he prepared the legal steps needed to search the compound for the distressed teenager identified as Sarah Jessup, and to arrest Dale Evans Barlow on the charge of sexual assault of a child in violation of Texas Penal Code Section 22.011. Since a child was involved, he conferred with the Texas Department of Family and Protective Services to have some of their specialists involved in the investigation. On Thursday, April 3rd, Judge Barbara Walther of the 51st District Court signed a search warrant. "I had learned over my years as a PI that things are not always as they seem, and my caution lights continued to blink as I listened to more calls from Sarah to Flora. Until enough evidence is available to say for certain that something is a fact, I will not take a position one way or the other. Although the girl was persuasive with her general story, discrepancies would occasionally pop up, including the way she had begun to sometimes shift from using the name of Sarah to calling herself Laura, and saying that Sarah was her twin sister down in the Texas compound. Scared, mixed-up kids often stumble through their stories, and this one was fairly accurate given the circumstances. I would have liked to have seen some more evidence, but if Sarah or Laura, or whatever her name was, needed help, time was critical. The circumstances had grown compelling enough for me to alert my comrade-in-arms, Gary Ingalls, who could push the information to the authorities in Mojave County, Arizona. I explained to him the saga of Sarah and played some of my tapes of her emotional calls. We brainstormed it for a while, and both of us concluded that some legal wheels needed to be set in motion to investigate the possibility that the girl was being held captive by her father in Short Creek. Independently and without knowledge of each other, authorities in several western states, including Gary and me, had begun responding to the disturbing calls from a child crying for help. The Texans got to the starting line first. Chapter 33. Standoff. By late afternoon on Thursday, April 3rd, a short string of dusty government sedans was driving north on U.S. 277, just outside of El Dorado, population 1,951, the only town in Schlaker County, Texas. After less than a mile, they peeled onto a chip seal track called County Road 300. The cars were carrying Brooks Long and three other Texas Rangers, County Sheriff David Doran, and two of his deputies, and nearly a dozen specialists from the Child Protective Services Division of the Texas Department of Family and Protective Services. They were headed for the YFZ Ranch. Everyone was on edge. The plan was to negotiate a soft entry into the compound, keeping things as low-key and friendly as possible. Nobody on the search team wanted this to blow into a repeat of Waco, the infamous 1993 violent standoff between the federal government and the Branch Davidian religious cult led by another maniacal prophet, David Koresh. Brooks Long, who had been at the Waco siege, remembered all too well that before it was over, some 54 adults and 21 children had died. Waco was only a 2-hour drive to the east, and it was very much on the minds of the investigators approaching the YFZ ranch. This time, Long made certain that advanced security precautions had been taken, a prudent measure because of the ranch residents' unpredictable nature. The police and CPS professionals had managed to keep such a tight lid on things that even the families and close friends of the officers involved were unaware of what was about to happen.
An unmanned aerial surveillance drone from a federal agency did a flyby and took photographs providing an up-to-date, accurate layout of the compound. Things appeared normal. Even with the recon flight, the exact number of people at the ranch remained uncertain. Sheriff Doran, relying upon church leaders and personal visits, estimated the FLDS population to be between 100 and 150. I have a lot of respect for the sheriff, but he and I were in sharp disagreement about those numbers. I knew the FLDS inhabitants routinely hid when any outsiders came around, and there was always a transient population of FLDS workers being brought in for specific construction projects. It would be futile to simply ask any church member, "How many people are here?" FLDS members would be expected either to stay quiet or to lie with smooth and practiced ease. My own guess was that there were at least 500 people at the ranch. Even a group the size of the sheriff's low estimate would be much too large for a handful of deputies and rangers if something went wrong. So several dozen officers from various agencies had been put on alert. If immediate backup was needed, a quick reaction force was stationed just out of sight at an abandoned federal anti-missile facility that once had been part of the Star Wars missile defense program. It was now the command post for the police operation at the FLDS compound. Sheriff Doran had established a civil relationship with the people at the ranch and their on-site leader, Bishop Merrill Jessup, over the past months. Both Doran and Long had been allowed on the ranch property without incident to deal with minor matters ranging from environmental issues to homeschooling inspections to a vehicle accident involving the death of a child. Those earlier meetings had been touchy, but cordial. If anyone stood a chance of getting past the front gate without igniting an incident, it would be them. In fact, they had considered just this sort of scenario for years as part of their normal what-if planning. The sheriff's office was too small to handle a major confrontation, so the ranger had accompanied the sheriff on previous visits, hoping to get the lay of the land in the event state assistance might someday be needed. This trip was of a much more serious nature than anything they had undertaken before at the ranch. Their plan was just to talk to Bishop Jessup and try to win his permission to peacefully let them do their jobs. The search team would be looking for 16-year-old Sarah Jessup Barlow, her child, and Dale Evans Barlow, the man purported to be her abusive husband. The search warrant allowed them to go into every building on the 1,691 acres of the YFZ ranch, because the people they sought might be anywhere. Significantly, the warrant would allow them into the huge temple that was the centerpiece of the entire property. Church leaders were certain to consider that to be a major encroachment onto sacred ground by Gentiles, and could be expected to oppose having the law paw through the building that was the heart of their secretive society. But the Texas lawmen were professionals who were used to having their way in matters of public safety. One way or another, they were determined to carry out their duties. The sedan slowed and stopped at a metal gate off County Road 300 that was secured by a chain and padlock. Beyond this cattle gate, a dirt road stretched for another mile to the primary entrance of the main compound, where an interior guard station with tinted windows squatted ominously, its roof bristling with communications antenna, satellite dishes, and spotlights. Sheriff Doran called Bishop Jessup and asked him to come out for a meeting. The gate barring the entrance into the ranch lands had been dented by a propane delivery truck and hung somewhat askew. It remained firmly locked, even after Jessup emerged to speak with Doran and Long. He listened politely, then entered into a time-consuming stall that went nowhere, telling them that he needed to make some calls to gather more information, and then contriving excuses as to why access was impossible. He told the officers that only about 250 men, women, and children were on the ranch. A lie. The authorities tolerated the charade in hopes of keeping things calm. One reason for the secrecy of their arrival was to avoid the media. It was hard enough keeping everyone safe, and negotiations on an even keel without having to attend to the press as well. They wanted to wrap things up before the reporters found out what was going on and descended on the scene. The stall was frustrating. At one point, Sheriff Doran found himself talking on the phone to a man who identified himself as Dale Barlow, the specific target of the warrant. Barlow was adamant that he was not even at the Texas compound, but in Arizona, and insisted that the officials should just take his word as the truth and go away. They refused. Even if this caller was indeed named Dale Barlow, how could they know it was the right one? There were at least two other men with the same name up in Short Creek. Even if this was the correct Dale Barlow, that did not get them any closer to finding Sarah, who was their more urgent priority. Had she been at the ranch with him and then been taken elsewhere before they arrived with the warrant? All the Barlow call did was eat more minutes off the clock on a time-sensitive warrant. Throughout those fruitless hours, the lawmen and child protection specialist watched the situation behind the gate become more dangerous for them. Pickup trucks had filtered from the ranch compound onto the entrance road, with several FLDS men in each, until nearly the entire mile-long track from the far gate to the security shack was clogged with randomly parked trucks. More than 50 men loitered in and around the approximately 20 vehicles posing a visible, defiant threat to the safety of the search team. This was a serious development. When the authorities realized their small party was outnumbered by a possibly hostile force, they called back to the Star Wars Command Center for reinforcements. Tactical teams were dispatched, and an armored personnel carrier on loan from neighboring Midland County drove up to the gate. The formidable armored vehicle had "Sheriff" written in large black letters on each side and was loaded with heavily armed officers, their bubble-like black helmets sticking out of the hatches. It was there as a show of muscle and for protection, not really to do battle. The hope was to dissuade the FLDS men from making any aggressive moves. Normally, when Texas Rangers serve a search warrant, they give little more warning than a hard knock on a door, followed by a loud announcement of who they are and what their business is, and then they make entry. Anyone or anything in the way will be moved aside, one way or another. The police at the ranch had a legal search warrant to execute, and had been patient long enough. Merrill Jessup was given a final warning to get out of the way or be arrested for obstruction of justice and failure to obey the lawful command of a peace officer. If necessary, the police could simply crush right through the blockade. There were no guns mounted on the bulky armored personnel carrier, but it was a combat-style vehicle that could roll right over the pickup trucks. In the face of that ultimatum, the bishop grudgingly stood aside, and the trucks moved out of the way while the authorities drove past the cattle gate and down the long road. It had taken almost 3 hours to travel that single mile, but they were at last on FLDS property. The search for Sarah could finally begin. About 10 o'clock that night, my friend Randy Mankin, editor of the weekly El Dorado Success, called me, sounding like he was wound pretty tight. "They're out there at the ranch right now serving warrants," he said. That got my attention. I grilled him for more information, but although he was a close friend of Sheriff Doran, he was empty beyond that one tidbit. Over the years, Randy had learned not to allow his obligations as a reporter to interfere with his friendship with the sheriff. They each had a job to do. But the intrepid Mankins had teamed with the owner of the local radio station and rigged a connection to the station's 100-foot-tall antenna, and that allowed them to pick up fragments of police radio conversations originating from the FLDS compound. Anything broadcast in the open was considered fair game. By using secure frequencies for the current operation, the police had kept things silent on the news for longer than anyone thought possible within such a close-knit community. Even the best reporters around had been excluded. Whatever might be happening at the ranch down in Texas sounded to me like a positive development. At last, the authorities were doing something, and there was hope of holding the outlaw church accountable for its crimes. But at the time, I had no idea that the momentous development in Texas had anything to do with the lengthy, disturbing calls to which I had been listening from Flora's source. After Randy's call, I was up most of the night working my sources, and by dawn, my telephone was ringing off the hook as news media outlets from around the country pounded me for information. I had by then appeared on numerous shows speaking about the FLDS, and good producers never throw away a telephone number. They were under pressure to find someone who knew something, anything, about what was happening in Texas. That I was in Utah did not matter as the media frenzy built. I could not complete one conversation or interview that morning without five more stacking up. In my view, the Texas authorities actually were doing much more than just refusing to tolerate child abuse. I thought the surprise raid might be the very thing to prevent what everyone most feared, another Waco or even a Jonestown. In that 1978 massacre, a similar enigmatic prophet, Jim Jones, had created a people's temple in Guyana, murdered a congressman and a reporter, and led 912 followers to their doom by drinking poison. I believe that past behavior is the best predictor of future behavior when it comes to religious fanaticism. Given the right conditions, I felt most FLDS members were fully capable of drinking the Kool-Aid. They followed Warren Jeff's orders without question. I feared the worst. Chapter 34. Search. Once the authorities were inside the FLDS compound, they discovered that the inhabitants had been busy while the roadside negotiations were dragging on. The faithful had used the time to come up with plans designed to foil the efforts of the law officers, and confusion reigned. It was obvious from the start that the number of residents at the ranch had been grossly underestimated. Hundreds of the FLDS faithful were there, and none would cooperate. The sterility of the place, as evidenced by the total absence of ordinary kids' possessions like bicycles or dolls, surprised the outsiders. When the police gave some of the more curious children rides in the big armored personnel carrier, FLDS adults reprimanded the youngsters and ordered them away. As the law enforcement team continued talks with Jessup and other leaders, the Child Protective Services workers set about trying to find Sarah, the girl who had made the calls. At first, they requested that all of the girls at the compound be brought to a central location, which was identified as a school. The FLDS responded by selecting only girls who were well-briefed and unlikely to give up any secrets. The stymied interviewers then decided to fan out into other buildings and homes to search for the rest of the girls. The CPS workers were escorted by police officers, but also by FLDS guides who were the eyes and ears for the church and served to intimidate anyone who was questioned. CPS worker Tina Martinez interviewed Leanne Nielsen Jessup, who appeared to be about 16. When Martinez asked her age, Leanne did not answer, but looked up at her husband, Leroy Jessup, who was present during the entire interview. "You are 18, Leroy coached. The girl then quickly attempted to convince Tina that she was indeed 18, that her birthday was March 23, 1991. She had a 10-month-old baby and was Leroy's fourth wife. As the investigators went about their business, young girls in their long dresses began investigating them right back. A friendly kid who looked about 13 approached a ranger. "Hello," she smiled and shyly asked, "what's your name?" The ranger looked down from beneath the brim of his big cowboy hat at the typically well-groomed FLDS girl who was carrying a journal. "My name's John," he replied, pleased at her cordial manner. The girl scurried off some distance and scribbled in her little book, then came back. "What's your last name, John?" "Smith," the ranger answered, hoping to strike up a conversation. The kid ran off again and wrote some more. Then she spun around so fast that her skirt flared in a circle, and all traces of politeness disappeared. She thrust an accusing finger at the Texas Ranger and shouted, "John Smith, in 1 year you will wither!" "What?" he blurted, dumbfounded. The charming child had turned into a soothsaying harridan in the blink of an eye. "In 1 year you will wither," the stern little voice repeated. Then she ran away and disappeared into the meandering flock of other neat little girls in long dresses. The ranger told me later that the kid had really creeped him out. The CPS interviews were proving to be equally disturbing and distorted. A girl might give one name, saying she was 16, and confirm that she was married, only to deny it all later. The teenager might then give an entirely different name, vow that she was not married, give a different age, and daintily disclaim any knowledge of a photograph on a nearby table that showed her with an older man and a baby. All of the girls stuck to the church script and insisted that no age was too young for them to be married. While the interviews were going on, 15 passenger vans belonging to the church shuttled children from place to place. Girls who had not been interviewed were whisked from homes that had not yet been entered by authorities and taken to places that had already been searched and cleared. Children would lie, claiming that they had already been interviewed when they had not. Tension was growing. Compounding the identification problem was how few surnames there were within the group. Jessup and Barlow are even more common within the FLDS than Smith and Jones are in a telephone book in Seattle or Atlanta. The different combinations of FLDS first, middle, and last names with no records to prove which are correct defy logic. It is not unusual to find children who are named after the prophet, Warren Steed Jeffs, or have various reworks such as Warren Jeffs Steed or Steed Warren Jeffs, although they may be related only distantly to the prophet or not at all. With females, the names change through marriages and when they are reassigned to new husbands, at which time their children's original names also change, no matter how old they are. Generations pass, but the same names echo over and over again. It makes things exceedingly frustrating for any outsider trying to make sense of the Byzantine FLDS genealogy. As the hours went by, there was still no sign of the Sarah who was the object of the search. There were some Sarah Barlows and Sarah Jessups, but not the Sarah Jessup Barlow they sought. Nor did they find any sign of the alleged abuser, Dale Evans Barlow. But as the night dragged into the early morning hours, everyone understood the investigation was no longer about helping just one girl. It was clear that multiple children had been abused and forced into polygamous sexual unions. Despite the deception and misinformation, within the first 6 hours, authorities found 18 girls between the estimated ages of 12 and 16 who were in various stages of pregnancy or had given birth. The law enforcement people could not ignore such an abundance of evidence that crimes had been committed. While the search continued in Texas, I plunged into working my contacts involved in the various investigations of the FLDS and found the entire network of church members was on edge as the police probed around the nooks and crannies of the Texas compound and interviewed its residents. The search at the YFZ ranch was regarded as an existential threat of the highest order. Sooner or later, the searchers would be faced with breaching the sacred white limestone temple that dominated the compound, something the FLDS leadership had no intention of allowing. Law enforcement was trying to be sensitive to the group's religious beliefs, but the authorities had learned that the FLDS could not be trusted. It was made clear to Merrill Jessup that the temple had to be searched and that the officers were ready to use whatever force necessary to carry out their lawful duty. The moment of truth would arrive when the search moved into the temple proper. Following the developments from my office in Utah, I realized that something was out of whack. I was always dubious about coincidences. I had been drawn into the long dialogue that Flora Jessup was having with a 16-year-old abused FLDS girl named Sarah, and now I had learned that the authorities in Texas also had been speaking with a Sarah who also claimed to be 16. The alleged abusers in their stories were different, a husband versus a father, as were the locations, a Texas ranch or an Arizona house. The chances that the cases were not somehow related looked pretty slim. I telephoned Sheriff Doran down in Schlaker County to alert him to the similarities between what he was doing and what was happening at my end. By the time I was able to get through to him at the ranch, the sheriff, who had been without sleep since the raid began, was clearly frazzled. He knew that I would not be calling in the middle of that mess if I did not think it was important, so he listened for a few minutes before his attention was abruptly snatched away. "Yeah, email me those recordings," he said, his voice quickening. "I gotta go, man. They're starting to take kids out of here." After talking with the sheriff, I remained at my computer keyboard to monitor the developments in Texas when my no-coincidences rule took another sharp jolt. I had received an email from still another FLDS girl asking for help. "I can't call the cops. It would only make it worse. It involves missing persons." Unlike the anonymous caller, I knew this contact extremely well. The message had been sent by none other than Candy Shapley, the one-time child bride whose grand jury testimony had once rocked the entire FLDS and precipitated Warren Jeff's run as a fugitive. I had worked hard to help prepare Candy emotionally to actually take the witness stand against the Prophet and against her abusive former husband, but at the critical moment she had backed down, apparently coerced by the church and her parents into keeping silent. Nevertheless, I had stayed in touch, because I try never to burn my sources. When I read her comment about missing persons in the email, I immediately thought about her twins and considered the possibility that the FLDS was once again using her children as hostages to make sure that Candy remained muzzled. I wrote back that if she wanted my help, I was on her side. The answer came back immediately. "Okay, so what if I was to tell you my girl is missing and I don't know where she is? I'm not saying she is. What would I do? Where would I start?" I wrote, "If my daughter was missing, I would kick over every rock and look behind every bush until I found her. And if that did not work, I would get mad dog mean. But everyone's circumstances are not the same. If you really, really want to find her, trust me and let me help you find her." She emailed back that she was undecided about what to do. We both had been through this before. I understood the pressure on her. Candy knew that if she summoned the courage to make a stand, that there would be a price to pay. She stated that, "All hell will break loose. My family will forever despise me and threaten me in some way." She knew it was now or never. Their so-called teachings and trainings known as brainwashing really mess with one's mind. Candy signed off, leaving me alone with my thoughts. Why was she contacting me right now, at this particularly anxious time, after months of silence? I also thought it curious that the urgent emails from someone as plugged into the FLDS as Candy Shapley had not mentioned a word about what was happening at the YFZ ranch, which was by now international news. The timing seemed more than accidental. Was she somehow involved with the Texas situation? Sheriff David Doran was watching part of his own personal nightmare come true. The authorities had found much more than they had anticipated, and while the situation remained peaceful, it had not gone well and was not yet over. State resources were being stretched to the brink. The authorities had been exceedingly careful, knowing that it is a traumatic experience for everyone involved when victims of abuse must be removed from their homes. None of the cops or the experienced social workers had ever imagined having to deal with such intense trauma on the vast scale that confronted them as Friday drew to a close. It was time for the Child Protective Services specialists to make some crucial decisions. Having been met with such confusion and lying, the CPS workers needed to get all of the children together if there was to be any hope of sorting out who was really who. That would be impossible while everybody remained at the ranch. Transportation was arranged, and by the end of the day, 162 FLDS children were moved away, many to a temporary shelter at the El Dorado Civic Center, where cots and beds were set up. They were later taken to the old restored Fort Concho in San Angelo to be housed until arrangements could be made for temporary foster care or group homes. Another decision was a shocker for me. Swayed by emotion for the distraught kids, the CPS allowed mothers to accompany their children to serve as buffers because the fearful kids had never lived in the outside world. Allowing possible abusers to stay with their victims was unprecedented. The FLDS leaders seized the opportunity and let only some of the mothers go, those capable of keeping the kids from spilling their guts about what actually went on at the ranch. The chosen moms brought along cell phones and cameras.